Andrew Talks to Chefs is an independent podcast. For current and past episodes, Andrew's blog, contact information, and more, please visit andrewtalkstochefs.com. To support us, please visit patreon.com/andrewtalkstochefs. Enjoy the show!
Andrew Talks to Chefs is brought to you in part by Mies, the revolutionary new interactive recipe tool for professional chefs and cooks. Designers use Figma, photographers use Photoshop. Now, finally, chefs have the right tool for recipe development, management, training, and evolution with Mies. Like mise en place, the term that inspired its name, Mies helps chefs and cooks be organized, ready, and efficient, save time and money, eliminate mistakes and redundancies, and guarantee consistency, whether in one restaurant or across a multi-unit company. Visit GetMeez, that's GetMeez.com/Andrew to learn more and sign up for a free trial membership. Andrew Talks to Chefs is brought to you in part by San Pellegrino Sparkling Natural Mineral Water. For more than 120 years, San Pellegrino has been inspiring people to savor life and tasteful moments around the table. As chefs and restaurants have evolved worldwide, San Pellegrino has always been there to complement the food they serve, the moments they create, and to support them in both good and challenging times. Learn more at sanpellegrino.com.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
There were just so many people there, and there was so much food on their tables. You know, I mean, it really was sort of the bacchanal that maybe I had feared, right? Like, people were kind of saying, like, I'll take the left side of the menu, you know, and of course they were, you know, and they were asking for the wine list. It was interesting reporting this story.
That is the voice of Hannah Raskin, founder of the new Substack, The Food Section, which covers food and related issues across the American South. She is our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses to make some sense of this. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and I am pleased to be bringing you this week an interview with a colleague of mine by the name of Hannah Raskin. Hannah was most recently a reporter and the restaurant critic for the Charleston Post and Courier newspaper. She is also the most recent past president of the Association of Food Journalists. She has also authored a book by the name of Yelp Help, which is just what it sounds like. And Hannah is a colleague of mine, someone I've had a chance to interact with on occasion over the years. She had been a guest actually to discuss the state of restaurant criticism several years ago on the podcast I used to do with my good friend Jimmy Bradley. That show was called The Front Burner. Some of you might remember it. She and I participated in a panel together at the New School. I think that was in 2019, my sense of time, as it has been for a lot of you, is a little bit thrown by the pandemic, but I believe that was in spring of 2019, if I'm not mistaken. I could be off by a year. And Hannah is also someone whose work, and we talk about this in the interview, whose ethics as a journalist I have tremendous respect for. So when she recently announced that she had launched a Substack called The Food Section, I wanted to get her on the podcast. As longtime listeners know, when friends and colleagues of mine whose work I respect put their own ventures out there into the world, such as, you know, their own podcasts and whatnot, we like to have them on the show and help with their liftoff and hopefully help with their success. So I invited Hannah to come on the show. We talk about why she launched the Substack and what its mission is, but I'll give you a little sense of it before we jump in. It's basically what you would expect from a food writer and critic. Everything from restaurant reviews to investigative reporting to features to opinion pieces and everything in between. It is a Substack, which, if you don't know, it's basically, that means it's a blog, but twice a week, if you are a subscriber, you will get the product delivered to your inbox. If you are listening to the show on the day that it drops, there's a sizable discount on the monthly rate available through midnight tonight. That's Friday, October 1st, 2021. But there will still be a discount in effect for the next several weeks and months. The discount decreases as time goes by. That's all explained by Hannah in the interview. And we also get into some of the early articles that have been posted to the site, including one that I think a lot of you listeners of this show will find very interesting about the state of friends and family, a tradition in the restaurant industry. We'll be back soon with a regular feature biographical interview on the show, but this is, as I've kind of been indicating recently, now that we're not doing multi-segment shows, at least for the time being, I intend to mix up episodes as we go along. Some of them will be shorter, newsier shows like this one, and then, of course, most of the time, we'll be airing traditional deep-dive biographical interviews with chef guests. I should also mention I'm off to the 50 Best tomorrow. The event is next week, but I'm traveling this Saturday, October 2nd, over to Europe. It'll be my first international travel since the pandemic began. It'll be my first time attending the 50 Best. I hope and expect to be interviewing some of the honorees while I'm there, and I hope to have a special report for you all shortly after I return. So with all that as prologue, I'm going to get to our interview. As always, our feature interview on the show is presented by San Pellegrino. Whether in life or on the plate, every chef has a story to tell. San Pellegrino proudly helps them share those stories in their restaurants and here on Andrew Talks to Chefs. The perfect complement to great food and meaningful interactions, San Pellegrino is delighted to be a part of the conversation. Learn more at sampellegrino.com. And with that, here's my conversation with Hannah Raskin, founder of The Food Section. Here you go. Hannah, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here. Congratulations on launching The Food Section. Before we get into some of the specific reporting you've been doing, why don't you just make the pitch? What is The Food Section?
Absolutely. And Andrew, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. The Food Section is an online newsletter covering food and drink across the American South. So it is featuring original independent reporting. It's a source for food journalism, the idea being that there are so many areas of the South where you can eat really well, but also so many areas of the South which are underserved in terms of quality journalism. The goal of this publication is to be a forum for that kind of coverage.
I mean, this is something, and you know, I don't know you that well, Hannah, but this is something I've really respected about you from afar. You really, in a time when a lot of lines have been blurred in terms of the ethics of journalism, in terms of the kind of church and state relationship between reporters and the people they cover. You're pretty old school about stuff. I don't know if you would use that phrase, but I want to read something from one of the posts that you put up in the lead up to launching The Food Section. This is what you wrote. As immediate past president of the Association of Food Journalists, that's a role that you held, I am keenly aware that most newspapers continue to treat food as a lighthearted diversion. This occurs despite the outsized role that restaurants play in Americans' lives, particularly in the realm of labor, race and gender relations, health, and their shared built environment. In the South, arguably the nation's leading food section, the scarcity of true food journalism is shameful. And then you later in the same piece say, it isn't all pretty. If you're looking for banana pudding recipes or saccharine recollections of ice cream socials gone by, this probably isn't the right newsletter for you. And then also in other places in your recent coverage on The Food Section, you have a piece about the tradition of friends and family, and you say until very recently, you'd never accepted such an invitation because you didn't think it was appropriate to accept free food in your role as a journalist, although that's obviously something that a lot of food journalists do. Can you just speak to kind of where this I don't even know what you would call it, moral or professional, or where this personal, where this personal point of view comes from for you, because you do seem to be, and I respect the hell out of it, just so I'm being clear, you do seem to really be committed to it at a time when it's ever harder to be.
It is. And but the amazing thing is there's so few people who are upholding, as you say, old school journalistic practices and ethics, that just doing that is enough to, you know, gain readers' trust and attention. I mean, I recommend it to everyone. Like, this is, it's an easy thing to do. The food isn't free, but you sure get the audience for it, because it's so scarce now, this sort of approach to coverage.
So you find that when you're able to interact with readers, you find that they appreciate this aspect of your protocols?
Oh, they love it. They love it. And when you say able to interact with readers, you know, I was at the paper here in Charleston for almost a decade before leaving to start the Substack that we're talking about today. And, you know, one of the reasons I really agonized over leaving the paper, in part because, you know, my old school thoughts really fit in well in a traditional newsroom. But largely because I have such a close relationship with my readers and with my audience, and I really didn't want to leave them. But again, that's forged through trust and them knowing that they could trust me.
What's it been like with people that you cover? Especially, I'm curious to know, you know, people who are on the younger side of the spectrum, of the age spectrum. Is it something that you feel puts a bit of a remove or a distance between you and the people you cover? Or do you find that they too tend to respect, you know, these policies that you enforce? I realize I'm asking you to generalize, but I'd love however you're able to answer that.
And no, I think you're absolutely right that this is sort of a generational thing, that, you know, there are older people in the industry who respect it, who've seen it before, for example, and folks who are just coming up who are kind of stunned by the whole approach. And does it create a distance? It does, but that's on purpose. Again, I believe I'm here to serve the reader, not the industry. So, you know, the idea that I work at a remove, I actually don't think is all bad.
I want to talk about also the little bit I read just a moment ago about how food sections, a lot of them are still sort of our parents' food sections, right? They're recipes and nostalgia pieces and all of that. And I'll just put my cards on the table. I don't know that I completely align with your point of view on this, only because I sometimes wonder as a reader, and I do in whatever ways I'm able to try to cover some of the same things you do. As a reader, I do wonder if the fact that the social, the economic, all of these things that are now getting, you know, a fair amount of coverage, certainly compared to even 5-10 years ago, I sometimes wonder if all of that belongs in the food sections. In other words, whether, you know, food sections, and I don't mean your thing, the food section, I mean food sections generically, does the next Me Too revelation belong in a food section, or does it belong in the national news section if it's a big celebrity?
It probably belongs in both places. I mean, that's a big story, but I am absolutely with you that, you know, food coverage should not be siloed. It doesn't belong primarily, you know, exclusively in the food section of a newspaper or any other publication. Of course, this is of general interest to everybody. That's why you and I both work in this field, I think, because, you know, it involves so many people. I mean, I will say when I first got to the newsroom here in Charleston, and I had worked many, you know, daily papers and alt weeklies prior to that, literally the features department was almost in the closet. And one of my first requests is, you know, I want to sit in the metro section. Like, I want to sit with the folks covering government and covering crime. Because to me, that's where food fits. And so, yes, I absolutely agree that these stories should not be confined to, you know, just people who are also looking for recipes. That doesn't make sense to me.
Have you always been drawn to the more news, you know, hard news side of the industry, or has that been an evolution for you as well?
So, I mean, I think I started out just as a plain old reporter, not a food writer of any kind. And then, you know, bopped around for a bunch of years in my 20s, like people do. But that's where I started out, was I started out as just a news reporter, you know, covering crime like everybody else. So I think I had that orientation from the outset. And then additionally, my first food focused jobs were at alt weeklies, which have never, you know, done the like cupcake recipes, right? So it's a different way of thinking about food.
let's talk about some of the reporting that you've already done. You just launched very recently, but already you've got some some great stuff up on your on your food section. One is the headline is "The Downside of Friends and Family." And, you know, this dovetails nicely with what we were just talking about. You, until recently, had never attended a friends and family dinner. I've been to a million of them. reading your kind of, fascination with the tradition as someone who hadn't done it, and then, you know, kind of your kind of amusement slash, I don't know, horror at what transpires at one of these things, and you know how much free food people are taking, was kind of interesting. Before we talk about just kind of the meat of the article, can you just maybe delineate your own education on this front? Because it is interesting to me that you just not that long ago attended your first one.
Yeah, right. So obviously I'm well aware of these events, and I give credit to all the publicists and other industry folks here in Charleston that they would always send an invitation knowing I would say no, just because I do like to keep tabs, you know, on when a place is opening and how they're presenting themselves. And so the publicists were great about inviting me when they knew I wouldn't come. But so I was left, as you say, to imagine what is happening at these things. I saw them on Instagram. Once in a while I'd hear people like, oh, that one was awesome. But I had no idea. I had no idea how it was conducted. So as I wrote in the story, the first time I ever went to one of these was a restaurant that I had covered on a weekly basis starting in last August, so August 2020. This was a restaurant recovery series. As I said, when I began it in August, I legitimately believed that none of the four restaurants, which I was chronicling on a weekly basis, was going to make it through. As you remember, it was a deep, dark time. It was back when we didn't know, you know, this is before the Recovery Act. And so this was one of them. And so they were a restaurant that had planned to open, I want to say, like, let's say March 15th, 2020, right? So they just never opened. And the question was, would they ever open? And by that time, when they did, and they had a friends and family to market, I knew I couldn't miss it.
And your experience of it? I mean, just in your own, people can go and read it, but just give us the nutshell version.
There were just so many people there, and there was so much food on their tables. You know, I mean, it really was sort of the bacchanal that maybe I had feared, right? Like, people were kind of saying, like, I'll take the left side of the menu, you know, and of course they were, you know, and they were asking for the wine list. It was interesting in reporting this story. Apparently, there are community differences. There are some places where the guests pay for their own drinks. There are some places where they pay for food, but not the drink. At least here in Charleston, the prevailing method is everything is free and folks know it.
And do they tip?
Do they tip? Yes, I think I saw at least one table, you know, ask for a credit card slip to, you know, to run a credit card so they could leave a tip. I think some do tip. But as I wrote in the story, some go home and yelp about it. So I think, you know, unless you really control your guest list, there can be a lot of downsides for the restaurant owners.
It was an education to me because I guess, or at least maybe this is a regional thing, you know, to me, traditionally, friends and family was always what it sounds like. It was friends and family. It was not press. There weren't really such things as influencers in the way we understand that term today. You know, people who can, you know, people who weren't journalists who could throw up, a post and reach tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people. And there were usually questionnaires at the end of the meal. Where you could give your notes, mm-hmm. like the comment cards at a film screening or notes at a theatrical dress rehearsal. And this would help people work out the kinks. As described in your piece, it is as much a kind of public relations exercise as it is that. And, you know, that was kind of educational to me. Am I accurate? It sounds like you consider it as much an influencer event as anything else.
Exactly. To me, at least, you know, and the folks I've talked to, it seems like it's really spiraled out of control. I think, as I wrote in the story, there's nothing wrong with inviting exactly, as you say, trusted friends and family who really want your business to succeed, and they have some knowledge of the industry so they can leave comments that are actually going to help it along. That's one thing, but that is not what friends and family has become. It has become a free-for-all gala, which is, and when I say free-for-all, if you Google friends and family, because it's, I mean, this is a great font of writing for a general audience, is I heard back from people like, I didn't even know such a thing existed, which I really do feel is my role to, you know, help folks who are not in the industry understand exactly how it operates. So if you Google it, like I think these people may very well have done, one of the first things you see is, how do I get an invite to a friends and family? And people know it's out there and they want to be part of it.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. The other thing your article gets into is, you know, is this a legitimate expense?
That's exactly right. And when we're talking about tens of thousands of dollars, and I mean tens of thousands of dollars in South Carolina, so I am sure in, you know, big northern cities, folks are, you know, laying out even more money for this. And we now know how many more expenses owners have really scrutinized in the past year. So if you put down $20,000 for your friends and family event, that's $20,000 maybe that you didn't use so that all your takeout packaging is environmentally friendly. You know, I mean, that's a big chunk of money, and it could really change the way you interact with the community.
I mean, I have been amazed that people are still doing it. You know, restaurants that have opened during the pandemic at whatever we're calling the phase we're in now. In fact, 20 minutes ago, I got invited to one for this Friday night.
It doesn't stop, man. And, I mean, and that's sort of what I was saying. The story, a lot of the restaurant owners feel like they have no choice. They feel that at least in some communities, it is expected, and that it has now become a part of hospitality that you give all your food and drink away, which is nuts. And, you know, as you say, there are those of us who would treat workers well and respect the opportunity to be in the restaurant and make sure to tip. But what we learned from COVID is not every restaurant goer behaves that way. And there, the sense of entitlement is keeping a lot of these people in the food, you know, in the friends and family game, even though they don't want to be in it.
Okay, let's talk about a community over the barrel. This is an amazing story. I mean, your subhead on it does kind of take it to the slightly more universal, resisting unchecked food and beverage expansion. But it is a story very unique to its time and place, right? It is about a business called The Barrel that essentially, what do we say, took over its neighborhood?
Very much so. So we're talking about James Island, South Carolina, which was, people outside of the area might know it as a Civil War site, or if they've traveled here as a tourist, they might know it as where Folly Beach is located. So, you know, a historic shrimping boat building area that's become a huge tourist spot. And so this is a small Gullah community, kind of an aging African-American community, just on the way to Folly Beach, 27 residents. Right on the, not even the outskirts of it, just the closest to the street, there is sort of this hut shack in a little tiny place that was built half a century ago as a bait and tackle shop. And as you say, it was more recently purchased by a young white guy who turned it into what he claimed would be a beer retail shop, but pretty quickly became a beer bar hangout where you could let your dogs run free. And so because he persisted with this, despite lack of permitting and so on, those 27 residents who I mentioned earlier had to contend with cars parked in their yards, with dogs running through their yards and doing what they do there, with the noise of live bands, with, you know, drunken customers stumbling back through their neighborhoods. It was a pretty messy scene.
Yeah. And as you met, you know, and these are, as you mentioned, the average age in this neighborhood is pretty far north. Well, go ahead. Tell people how this turned out, because, I mean, at the end of the day, The Barrel did not win. The neighborhood won. But why don't you go ahead and describe this?
Absolutely. So this had been going on for a few years. As I said, we're talking about, you know, Black residents of Charleston County in their 70s, 80s, and 90s. And they're tired and they gave up and they didn't think that the city would help. And a young man, what they consider young, he's in his 60s, who had grown up in the community, moved back home. His mother had passed away and he moved into the home he built for her. And he said, we're going to fix this. And rather than continuing to try and negotiate with the business owner, who had absolutely no interest in doing so, he made sure the city stepped up and said, look, this is a no parking area. We want no parking signs. You know, this is a city road. We want a yellow line down the middle, like everything we need in place so that people will follow the rules. And then we expect you as the city to enforce them. And when they didn't, he made sure his residents got on the phone day after day after day, complaining about every violation that they witnessed. And finally, the city gave in. And when the residents said, look, come and count the number of people in this building, come and count the number of cars parked in this parking lot, all of which were in violation of what they had been permitted for. And so the bar was ultimately shut down.
And the owner's now on, I guess, a permanent ski trip. I'm not being funny. That's what he told you. You know, it's a real David and Goliath story. I think this makes the argument for, you know, the whole Substack movement that you're a part of, right? I mean, this is a piece that, a year ago you might have written this for your old newspaper.
That's right. That's right.
You know, and now here it is on your site. Can we just talk about process? Because you mention in just a little preamble to the piece that you say, one of the reasons I felt compelled to start the food section was I was worried about folks who didn't have a local food journalist to call when important stories were going untold. And then you say, but I'm still fielding calls from the Charleston area, which is how this story got started. So without, you know, giving away your source or your contact, I mean, it sounds like what? Someone you knew from Charleston just got in touch and said, this is something you should sniff out?
I mean, that is the great part of local journalism. And that is, you know, why ultimately I hope that the food section, my Substack, will employ people across the South, because it's very hard to do this alone. I never met this person. I don't know anything about this person, but my name is known around here. Literally, when I shared the link with her for the story this week, I'm reading to you from my text. She wrote back, thank you for listening. I had no idea where to turn or how to help. You shined a light on this, and I am so thankful, which really means a lot. She saw something. I mean, it was a real see something, say something. And I was really glad to be able to listen.
Again, going back to how we started this conversation, right? There's no recipe you're going to run that's going to have the impact of a story like this. And there's no feeling you're going to get from a reader, no matter how much they loved it, that you got from, you know, that text that you just described, right? I mean, there are stakes in all of this.
Absolutely. And I should say, too, I am not anti-recipe. I mean, there are just some people who do it so well. That's, you know, it's just that's not the niche I see.
But it's not just that. You also do. I mean, yes, you're not a recipe person, but you do write about restaurants. You do write about, food that people might go out of their way for. You also write about biscuits. Can you talk about your commitment to the biscuit?
I mean, you know, you look for kind of those universals, and certainly in the South, the biscuit is one, although much like barbecue, it is sometimes the object of debate and contention. People are very, very attached to biscuits and how they're made. But they took on greater significance, I think, during the pandemic, because the biscuit house is like the ultimate takeout here in the South. We don't have the same kind of takeout it's a stereotype, but it's true. We work at a different speed in this region, so it's not, you know, there's a whole like urban rural dynamic, but you know, we just don't have as many quick to go places. But the biscuit house is very much one of them. And certainly last summer, when, anytime pre-vaccination, when there was still concern about eating inside, not here, not that there were laws about it, but when there was a concern, you would see cars down the block outside of these independent-owned biscuit shops. Everyone seems to have a great story. So as you say, each week in my like midweek news roundup, I'm including a short profile of one of these biscuit places.
Yeah. And you say in there, you know, burgers and pizza were big draws during the pandemic. But as you say, in the South, you know, the drive-through biscuit phenomenon, reached a new level. Are you able to preview or tease people with any upcoming things you're working on?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very excited that this weekend I am going to Charlotte to the Fast Casual Summit, where all the fast casual owners from across the country are going to be talking about the future of that kind of dining. So I'm excited to report on that. I'll be at the Southern Foodways Alliance Symposium later this month. I'll be back in Charlotte for the Bay Haven Food Festival, which is the Black food festival that the folks behind Leah and Louise are putting together. So, yeah, I don't know all what stories will come out of those, but I imagine some good ones.
Your Substack, it shows up in your inbox twice a week. And what's the price of admission for people?
through October 1 till like the clock strikes 11:59 on Friday night, it remains 40% off and then drops 30, 20 month by month. So you want to get that 40% off deal, but the standard price is $9 a month or $99 a year.
What's it like, Hannah? I mean, this feels like, I mean, you're not the only person I know who's made this leap. It feels kind of brave to me. I feel like it must be exciting. Like I hear you talk about, you know, going to this fast casual gathering, and you know, it's one thing to do that, you know, under the auspices of a paper. It's another thing entirely to do that, you know, for your own quote unquote publication. I know that feeling and it's amazing. But what's kind of the mix of emotions you have as you're kind of, you know, just in the first weeks of this thing being live?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, since the publication is mine, it certainly is interesting to be a business owner for the first time. You know, as we talked about earlier, old school ethics and ways of thinking, you know, sales and editorial never crossed in the newsrooms where I worked. And now I kind of regret it because I didn't learn a damn thing about promotions and advertising and all that. So, you know, like anyone who's gone freelance, there's that component, which is interesting. It's interesting, too, to kind of be an individual player instead of on a team. You know, what's great is that I was funded partially by the Substack Local grant to get started, and that allows me 15 hours a month of a consulting editor's time. And I'm working with Steve Fennessy, who was the editor at Atlanta Magazine for years and years and years. And, you know, it was the barrel piece. And he's like, well, you need to be in this story more. And that was such a weird idea for me, because, again, coming from the newsroom mentality, it's like you're not supposed to really stand out, and certainly not in your story. So, you know, as a writer, that's an interesting transition. It's exciting. It's weird. I get a lot less emails. I don't get all my calls returned. Nobody, you know, has heard of the Substack yet, but I hope they will.
I have no doubt. No one's going to ignore Hannah Raskin for long. Well, listen, congratulations on the launch. As I texted you yesterday, you know, I spent my morning reading up on all the articles in preparation for this call. I think it's a wonderful thing, and I wish you all the best with it. I look forward to continuing to follow it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this.
And that's our show for today. Again, my thanks to Hannah Raskin for joining us. I do encourage you to check out the food section. There is a link to the site in the episode description of today's show, at Apple Podcasts, and also on the Andrew Talks to Chefs website, where the links are functional. Andrew Talks to Chefs is produced by Table 12 Productions. The show is written, booked, edited, mixed, and hosted by me, Andrew Friedman. If you would like to support us, the way we ask you to do that is to simply let people know about the show in this increasingly crowded podcast era. You can mention it to friends, post about it on social media, or leave us a rating, or especially a review at Apple Podcasts, which really does help people find the show. Our thanks, as always, to After School Special for our music. Please check out their album, Double Barrel, Single Entendre, on iTunes. Please do follow us on Instagram. Our handle there is @ChefPodcast. Thank you for listening, and we will see you back here soon with another episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs.